you're willing to hear me, what your biggest problem is. You think you shouldn't have them. Problems are what make us grow. Problems are what sculpt our soul. Problems are what make us become more. If we can realize that life is always happening for us, not to us, game over, all the pain and suffering disappears. Your problem is your gift.
People want to find an ending. There isn't an ending. You're never going to be truly happy. You're never going to be truly sad if you just continue. That's just life. You get a journey, you get one ride at this thing, and then when it's over, it's over. Because the moment you think you have security, the moment you get complacent, is the moment you die. I think it's important people write down their goals, because otherwise they'll just find themselves in the rat race, continuing, continuing.
Now, to achieve success in every area of your life, you have to develop the habits of highly successful and hardworking people. Successful people understand that they must work in a straight line to get from where they are to where they want to go without diversion or distraction. If you want to accomplish your goals, you must be sure that everything you do is taking you in that direction, and then develop good habits to get you there.
We all have a habit of hesitating. We have an idea. You're sitting in a meeting. You have this incredible idea. And instead of just, you know, saying it, you stop and you hesitate. Now, what none of us realize is that when you hesitate, just that moment, that micro moment, that small hesitation, it sends a stress signal to your brain.
It is easy to be motivated to succeed in the beginning of an endeavor and when you are close to the end. The most difficult part, and the part where people quit, is when they are in the thick of it, and it is unclear whether they have the strength and stamina to make it the rest of the way.
I'm never going to feel like doing the things that are tough or difficult or uncertain or scary or new, so I need to stop waiting until I feel like it.
Whatever you focus on, you'll feel, even if it's not true. And so decisions shape destiny. It's not our conditions, it's our decisions about what to focus on, what the meaning is, and what we're going to do. But we focus on a very small part of life, and whatever we focus on, we feel. You don't just get a result without some kind of action, without some form of ritual. Ritual meaning actions you do consistently. Now, do you think those people that are out there working out 5 days a week, do they have more time than you do? Or I have, or anybody else? Of course not. Is their life less busy? Of course not. It's just a must for them. They must work out that way, and they've made that turn, their life's changed. And take these huge challenges you got, break them down into little bite-sized steps. Little things you do each day that after you do them, you get so much momentum that it's easy to succeed. You're not overwhelmed. You have these victory day after day after day on little things. You literally just condition your body and emotion with a couple little rituals. So it doesn't matter what's going on in your world. You feel that strength, and it's not fake. It's not some pump up. It's coming from inside you, and it works. Rituals define us. See, all the results in your life are coming from your rituals. They start with a standard and then have rituals that follow it up. Success and failure are not giant events. They don't just show up. You don't just suddenly become successful or suddenly have this cataclysmic event that makes you fail. It may look that way, but failure comes from all the little things. It's failure to make the call. It's failure to check the books. It's failure to say, I'm sorry. It's failure to push yourself to do things physically that you don't want to do. And all those little failures, day after day, come together until one day some cataclysmic event happens and you blame that. That event happened because you missed all the little stuff. And success, by the way, is not some overnight event. It's all these little things. Success is having a vision. Success is making it compelling. Success is really seeing it, feeling it every day with strong enough reasons. Success is feeling the sense that I'm here to grow and I'm here to give something to the world more than just myself. Success is caring about other people. Success is calling and saying, I love you, in the middle of the day for no damn reason. You need to have some rituals, some cool things you do that nobody else does that gives you a better life than anybody else has. All the little stuff. That's where success comes from. You just have a vision and you don't have the rituals, stop lying to yourself.
What's been your biggest accomplishment, you think?
Bouncing back, number one, is refusing to listen to the negative chatter in my own head, refusing to listen to other people's perception of me, creating something from absolutely nothing. So I got, there's the books, there's the TV, there's the all that stuff. But my biggest accomplishment is being willing to give myself 1,000 second chances. And every time I got to 999, I press reset.
Yeah.
I didn't ask permission. I gave notice. Yeah. At some point, I have to stop asking, can I be great? Can I be brilliant? Can I be okay and still be accepted? I just stopped asking permission and just gave notice unapologetically, and not in a braggadocious way, not in a way that shrunk anyone else, in a way that said, I only got one life, and I'm going to ride this one till the wheels fall off. And then all the other stuff came.
Wow.
As a result of a decision I made.
Right. But it was a decision.
It was a decision. But it was, and it didn't come from, a motivational experience. It didn't come from an inspiring teacher. It came from hitting rock bottom.
Okay, let's talk about that. Because this was the thing that when you and I were talking that really struck me. Because I had been there.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to hear how you had turned it around. Because you can be rock bottom and turn it around. That's the best turnaround, because at rock bottom, hell, ain't no other way to go.
Right.
You got to go up. So that's a great time. You climbed to the top. Tell everybody about this journey.
I struggled all through school. The last time I took English class, I got a fail. And my English teacher said I was the weakest writer she ever met in her entire life. The last time I took a speech class, same year, I got a D minus in speech, and my speech teacher said, Lisa, quote unquote, I recommend you never speak in public, that you get a desk job. So that was the beginning of my life. That was my 19-year-old experience. And then I go on and I'm trying to figure it out. I was obedient. I went and got a job in accounting. I was in the collection department for 7 years. Y'all don't know, I'm dangerous to accounting. I'm just dangerous. And I'm in collections, and you should never put a broke person in collections. Never, because everybody's reasons sound good to me. I might sound funny, but it was real. Not only did I say, girl, don't you worry about paying that. I'm going to take your name off the list. Somebody went to jail because I was in collections. I got fired from 5 different jobs.
Yeah.
And then I got pregnant with my son unexpectedly. And then at 8 months, my son's father went to prison. I had to get on government's assistance to have my baby. I was on WIC, Women, Infant, and Children, to feed my child. And when my son was 8 months old, I went to the ATM to get $20 out the bank because I didn't have any Pampers for him. And in order to get $20 out, you got that $20 in. I had $11.42. And I still can't tell the story without getting emotional because it's my story. Mm-hmm. For 2 days, I had to wrap my son in a towel. But something happened, Steve, in those 2 days. I was at rock bottom. I was broke and I was broken. Inglewood, California. My son laying on his back at 8 months. I have a towel over him and I have my hand on his stomach saying, don't you worry, Jelani. Mommy will never be this broke again. And I made a decision. I was bankrupt. And every stinking thinking I had, I was bankrupt and trying to protect my pride. I was bankrupt and trying to be all that in a bag of chips and a bowl of grits falsified. I was bankrupt and trying to not ask anyone for help. I was bankrupt in everything that was holding me and keeping me where I was. I've always talked a good game, but I wasn't doing anything with my gift. And all that thing about potential, I was tired of having potential. I wanted to have my now. And I looked at that baby at 8 months and I said, I want to transform your life because you didn't ask to come into this chaos. As an African-American male child in South Central Los Angeles, with a single mother whose father's in prison, he had a 66% chance of going to prison himself. Not on my watch. Mm. Not on my watch. So if I have to be willing to drastically transform myself so that I can become the woman that I know I can be.
Right.
And that's what I began to do. I was radical.
What did you do, Lisa? What did you do to change your life?
First, I realized I couldn't grow with people who were struggling like me. That whole, I don't want to leave nobody behind. No, I don't want to stay with y'all.
Right.
You don't even want to be here. Yeah. Like, I don't want to be the queen of this block.
Yeah.
And I became okay with the fact that It doesn't make me any less committed to my community, committed to my culture, committed to my family. The best thing I can do for you is not stay here with you.
That's right.
When I got that, I went to places I'd never seen before. I went to conferences where people were talking about money, talking about prosperity.
Yeah.
Talking about, it was like, no habla español. What y'all talking about? ROIs and PPMs and term agreements and capital fundraising and bottom lines. And what is it? I'm going to stay until I learn what you're talking about. I went to the same conference 42 times. And there I raised $532,000 in capital for my company to start my dream. And my dream was to transform teen lives. I want to teach teens how to fall madly in love with themselves and how to make integrity-based decisions. And I got it funded and I started working. And that was the beginning of me rescuing myself. I realized that I am my rescue. No one else is my rescue.
Anybody can dream it, but you'll never see it until you're willing to be committed to it. I was telling somebody the other day, when I didn't have anything, church didn't have any members, I'd get off work, working at Carby, and drive up the road and work on the church till I had to turn around and go back to work. We worked when we didn't have food. We worked when we didn't have lights. I was putting my whole check in the offering, all of it, trying to keep it going. When I finally got some staff, I went on the road preaching. And whatever I made on the road preaching, I brought it home to make the payroll of the staff. And sometimes I got them paid and couldn't pay me. Commitments. Looked like a fool. Didn't have any clothes. Suits was falling off me. Lining wore out my clothes. Couldn't send them to the cleaners. Had to wash my suit in the washing machine. They laughed at me. Looked like an old raggedy country preacher. I had holes in my shoes. I couldn't kneel down and pray because if I knelt down to pray, they would see holes in my shoes. They laughed at me. They said that boy's lost his mind. He'll never be nothing. He stutters. He's got a lisp when he speaks. He'll never be a preacher. I don't care what you say. If you are committed to what you believe.
If I think I cannot do it, I already canceled it. Yeah. Some really crazy things, I believe I can do it, I already do it.
Like what?
Like jump over the building, crash by the hovercraft, jump from the light, 72 feet high with no net. And there's so many things. Even today, I look at the old film, look at myself. Sometimes I really smile. I'm glad. Even I know I get hurt, I broke my ankle, I'm so happy I did it. If today, I cannot do it anymore. Yeah, I'm. So whatever you want to do, whatever you, I always tell the students, whatever you do the, when you're young, do it. You might get hurt. Or you're learning a piano, you're learning a martial art. Between 10 or 20, 10 years, learn whatever you can. Those years, like me, I just do. 10 years later, now, forever, the things you learn, or the the success I have, forever. Don't regret one day. I should do it right now. I should. No, it's too late. Do it when you were young.
I had three rules, pretty much, that I stuck with. Practically all the time. I'd learned these prior to coming to UCLA, and I decided they were very important. One was never be late. Never be late. Later on, I said certain things that I had. The players, if we're leaving for someone, they had to be neat and clean. There was a time when I made them wear jackets and shirts and ties, and then I saw our chancellor coming to school in denims and turtlenecks, and I thought it was a little not right for me to keep this other, so I let them just, they had to be neat and clean. And I had one of my greatest players that you probably heard of, Bill Walton, he came, and I guess the bus were leaving for somewhere and to play, and he wasn't clean and neat, so I would let him go. He couldn't get on the bus. He had to go home and get cleaned up to get to the airport if he did. So I was a stickler for that. I believed in that. I believe in time, very important. I believe you should be on time, but I felt at practice, for example, we start on time, we close on time. The youngsters didn't have to feel that we're going to keep them over. When I speak at coaching clinics, I often tell young coaches, and the coaching clinics, more or less, they'll be the younger coaches getting in the profession, and most of them are young, you know, and probably newly married, and I tell them, don't run practices late, because you'll go home in a bad mood, and that's not good for a young married man to go home in a bad mood. When you get older, it doesn't make any difference, but... So I did believe on time. I believe starting on time, and I believe closing on time. And another one I had was not one word of profanity. One word of profanity, and you are out of here for the day. And if I see it in a game, you're going to come out and sit on the bench. And the third one was never criticize a teammate. I didn't want that. I used to tell them I was paid to do that. That's my job. I'm paid to do it. Pitifully poor, but I am paid to do it. Not like the coaches today, for gracious sakes, no. It's a little different than it was in my day. But those are the three things that I stuck with pretty closely all the time. And those actually came from my dad. And that's what he tried to teach me and my brothers at one time.
You are responsible for your life. I've known this. I've known this since The Color Purple. In 1985, I've probably told you the story when I did The Color Purple, but in 1985, I did The Color Purple. Prior to that, I had read the book, Larry. And this is when I got the secret thing, but I didn't know it was called The Secret. I read the book, The Color Purple, and then went out and got books for everybody else I knew. And I was obsessed about this story, obsessed about it. I ate, slept, thought all the time about The Color Purple. I moved to Chicago. I get a call from a casting agent asking, would I like to come and audition for a movie? I've never gotten a call in my life from anybody for a movie or anything like that. And I say, is it The Color Purple? And he says, no, it's a movie called Moonsong. And I go, well, I've been praying for The Color Purple. And I go to the audition, and of course it was The Color Purple. I audition. I don't hear anything for months. And I go to this fat farm, and I think it's because I'm fat, because I was about 212 pounds at the time. And I think, I didn't get the call back because I'm so fat. And I'm at this fat farm, and I'm praying and crying, saying to God, help me let this go, because I wanted to be in this movie so much. I wanted it, I wanted it, I wanted it. I thought I was going to be in the movie. There's all these signs that I should be in the movie. And I go to this fat farm, and I'm praying and crying. And as I'm on the track singing the song, I surrender all, I surrender all to thee, my blessed Savior, I surrender all. I'm singing that song, praying and crying. A woman comes out to me, and she says, on the track, it's raining, and she says, there's a phone call for you. And the phone call was Steven Spielberg saying, I want to see you in my office in California tomorrow. Now, what I learned from that moment absolutely changed my life forever, because I had drawn The Color Purple into my life. I didn't know Steven Spielberg. I didn't know Quincy Jones, who saw me in Chicago in 1984. He was there for a lawsuit that was being filed against Michael Jackson, because he'd been working on his Thriller album. And he saw me on AM Chicago and said, that's Sophia. Now, I didn't know him. I didn't know anybody that had anything to do with that. But I knew that I had drawn that into my life. And it changed the way I thought about my life forever.
Dear son-in-law, Miss Seeley, you keep on advising him like you do.
It is very true that the way you think creates reality for yourself. There are other factors going on. So it's not everything. But you really can change your own reality based on the way that you think.
I graduated college, and I have, you know, this degree in fine arts, and my dad saw me coming and going to work every day, and he was like, what are you doing? And I was like, making a living. What are you talking about? And I was in a transitional period because my son and father and I, we had just broken up, and I had this degree, and I was just living. And my dad saw it, and he was like, how do you expect to catch fish on dry land? And I was like, what? He always spoke in metaphors. I was like, can you just speak plain English? He was like, How are you going to get acting jobs when they're not here? You need to go to L.A. where the jobs are. So my family threw a party. We were broke. They raised $700, and I moved to L.A. And I took my son in. My dad, may rest in peace. He was like, maybe you should leave Marcel here. And I was like, I'm not leaving my son. It's my kid. And then I got out and freaked out. I was like, maybe I should send him back. And my dad was like, no, that's your blessing. He's your blessing. He's going to keep you focused. You were right. Your instinct was right. You should have taken him. So $700. My son is now 21. He's in school now. He's in the studying. Right. And look at me. So that's a good story. Yeah.